Hi, this is Lindy and the Papillons. You're listening to Bad Dog Agility, where the naughty dogs train.
I'm Esteban.
And I'm Sarah, and this is episode 39. Today we're going to talk about tugging with your agility dog. And we have a very special guest joining us on the podcast, Michael Ellis, a fantastic dog trainer and instructor who specializes in Schutzhund and ring sport. In the past, he served as president of the American Working Malinois Association, and he also breeds working Malinois under the kennel name Lou du Soleil. For our agility listeners, you can go to the Clean Run website and type Michael Ellis in the search box to find three of Michael's DVDs: The Power of Training Dogs with Food, The Power of Playing Tug with Your Dog, and Advanced Concepts and Motivation. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Hello, Esteban. Hello, Sarah.
Thank you for joining us. You know, we first came across your work with protection dogs back when we were looking for ways to increase motivation and drive in our own agility dogs. You train and compete in a sport that's very physically and mentally demanding for both dog and handler. You're basically doing obedience tracking and protection work. And is it right that you do that all on the same day?
Yeah, in Schutzhund, you do it all on the same day. In Mondiering, you actually, it's sans tracking, but it is obedience, jumping, and protection work, all done straight through, actually, without breaks. So both very physically demanding sports.
Awesome. You know, it's a sport with a very different image in the minds of dog agility competitors, but an image that's changed, I think, rapidly changing in recent years. We found your work to be very consistent with our own in terms of using positive reinforcement, or what in your DVDs you call marker training, especially in teaching people to play tug with their dogs. So I wanted to start there. Let's talk a little theory. When you talk about drive and motivation in your dogs, what exactly do you mean?
Well, I think it's a really good question. The term drive gets thrown around a lot in dog training, and behaviorists tend to have a different idea in mind than us trainers do. Behaviorists have a tendency to look at it as a biological imperative kind of drive. What we use the term for is just to mean levels of motivation. So if I say a dog has high prey drive, what I mean is that dog has high motivation to chase and put their mouth on things ultimately. And like you mentioned, I think almost all progressive dog trainers across all disciplines these days are interested in what I would call reward-based training, primarily teaching at least through reward-based training. And motivation, or high levels of motivation for some kind of reward, be it food or play or biting or jumping activity, but high levels of motivation drive that whole process. And if we don't have high levels of motivation, our reward-based training really falls on its face.
Well, we have talked on the podcast previously about using tugging specifically as our reward. And, you know, obviously we can teach a lot of things with food, but in agility, tugging becomes such a powerful reward because it allows us to reward the dog in a location of our choosing. So we can throw that tug toy at the end of the line and reward our dog for their forward movement. It doesn't always have to be from our hand or coming back to us. And, you know, with movement being so important in agility, that's an important component of the reward.
That makes perfect sense to me. And ultimately, it's the same kind of thing in high-level obedience. Reward placement, we call it, dictates a lot of the long-term integrity of certain behaviors. So if I produce the reward when I'm healing across my body, then the dog starts to crab and get in front of me. If I produce it away from my body, I can move them off my leg. There's a whole bunch of those things. And if you want the dog close to you, you produce the reward in close to you. If you want the dog to move away from you, away, or look away from you, same thing as in agility. And so I agree 100%. Tugging is a fantastic way of not only motivating the dog, but also a way of altering your reward placement depending on the behavior you're working on. And then also, it's what I consider the most interactive reward that we can have with our dogs. So we're always striving for what we call interactive rewards, or things that the dogs can do directly with their handlers, because not only is it a reward for behavior, but also it's a relationship builder, and tug is sort of the quintessential interactive reward.
Right. And preparing for this podcast, I was looking at the Advanced Concepts and Motivation DVD, and you talk a little bit there about reward and the difference between reward as an object versus reward as kind of an event. You know, for our listeners who aren't familiar with that idea, could you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Over the years, kind of having my journey went from being a very compulsion-oriented trainer into a more reward-based trainer. And as I started to discover reward-based training, I was really excited about it. And I started focusing on what kind of reward I was going to use. So were you going to use food? Were you going to use a ball? Were you going to use a tug? And what I found over time is that the item itself doesn't matter as much. It's the activity that takes place with the item and the relationship between the dog and the handler during that activity. And I find that rewards can be much more valuable and meaningful to the dog, and they'll work harder to access them if they are like little mini events. And I should be able to play tug with my dog, for instance, with a water bottle, a stick, a tug toy, a piece of my sock, whatever. And it's less about the object itself and more about what the dog and I do together. And that tends to promote focus on me, relationship-related aspects of it. And it also allows me the freedom of not relying on a specific kind of object.
Right. I know a lot of obedience trainers, even when using food, will teach the dog to jump up for the food. So they kind of have to work for it a little bit, and you kind of activate a little bit of that, almost that chase, as you produce this hunk of food between your fingers and they leap up for it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a huge deal. We actually, in our food training now, has become, it doesn't look anything like our food training looked 10 years ago. Before, we would just kind of hand a dog a piece of food, and we would frequently kind of tell them to be careful so they don't bite the ends of our fingers as we gave it to them. And now we're using food very dynamically, like we would a toy. Actually, we'll jump and have them chase the food in our hands, and we throw it, we run and have them chase us and then give us the food. So it's much more of a prey-play type activity, even when we're using food.
Now, I think that might be something that's relatively new, or agility people might not be familiar with that. I think we could all learn there. Because I think what has happened over the last several years, at least in agility, is as people have come to realize that the relationship is so important, tugging is a great use of a reward as far as placement and, you know, very agility specific things that we're trying to teach the dog. There's been such an emphasis on focus and tugging that there is a group of dogs, a small percent of dogs, that they just don't seem to enjoy tugging, or, you know, they're not taught tugging appropriately, or, you know, they just don't seem to have the desire for it. And it causes a lot of stress and friction between students and instructors. And even, you know, when agility handlers have multiple dogs and they've got one dog that's a great tugger, another dog comes along and they just don't tug the same way. And you mentioned in your DVD, you know, that tugging is not ideal, or doesn't have the same impact, at least, for every single dog. So what can we do for those dogs who kind of struggle with the tugging a little bit in terms of motivation and building the kind of motivation we need to do very difficult, demanding work where there's going to be a lot of failure in practice?
Well, and I also think, just to add to that, that agility is very different from Shih Tzu in the range of breeds that you have. So in Shih Tzu, you know, you're basically working with working breeds. Almost exclusively, and they're going to have a lot of common characteristics. And I know there'll be variability from dog to dog, but you've still got a much more narrow range. And in agility, you've got, you know, every breed of dog, everything, you know, and so with all of their different characteristics and things that they like and don't like and everything. So, what kind of thoughts do you have on that situation?
I think you guys touch on several points that are really important. One, you're right. In protection sports, we're dealing with dogs that are bred for 100 years to use their mouth. So if I do things right, not every one of them likes to, but if I do things right, they're much, much more likely. And trainers have to be careful not to not only beat themselves up because their dog's not playing tug like a Malinois or German Shepherd or a Rottweiler or a Doberman or a dog that's been bred to do those things, but also so that you don't try to force the dog into doing something that they don't find satisfying. Ultimately, at the end of the day, the activity is supposed to be reinforcing to the dog. The dog's supposed to enjoy it. And if I kind of browbeat the dog and try to force them to engage in activity that they don't find some kind of personal satisfaction in, then that's not going to be a very functional reward. And so there are failures, dogs that aren't playing tug well, dogs that aren't motivated for the activity because the mechanics of their handlers are not good. They weren't taught appropriately at the right time developmentally. The skill of the person playing tug with them was not good, and they might have created conflict between the dog and the handler. Another thing that we can probably bring up later, but about when you're making rules around tugging, that's one of the most difficult aspects of tugging. As I try to teach when tugging's not very useful if my dog doesn't let go of the tug, doesn't bring the tug back to me. And while I'm making those rules, sometimes I can get kind of afoul of my dog and make them avoidant to me in some fashion, and I can take some of the fun out of the activity. So there are possible mechanical problems that the handler can address, but also just not every dog is going to play tug in a meaningful way. And at some point, we have to recognize that and stop forcing the dog to try to do something that they don't like and find something that they do. The other thing that's kind of interesting is different dogs get satisfaction from different aspects of the play. And some dogs are more chasers. They like lots of movement, and they're more naturally possessive. They like it if they can win the tug from you and carry it around a little bit. Other dogs like the kind of physical force of the fighting, and they like you to push on them and shove against them, be kind of rough with them. And so I have to look at each individual dog and kind of determine what part of that whole behavior chain do they find satisfying, and can I exploit that and intensify that, and can I make it fit my rules so that it's a productive reward?
Well, that's a very interesting way to break down as far as different points all along that basically behavior chain and see what's most satisfying to the dog. And I think that's just as protection dog trainers, you think about that to a much higher level than we do as agility trainers. You know, in agility, we're obsessed with things like jumping style, mm-hmm. jumping skills, different things like that. And that's why we found so much value in what you were offering as far as tugging and motivation, because we felt like who would know more about tugging than the people whose dogs are virtually graded on how they tug, how they put things in their mouths and grip and hold and all that sort of thing. So let's talk about some common problems that we see as agility people as it relates to tugging and games of that sort. Sure. So the first one is someone will come to us and say, hey, you know, my dog's a pretty okay tugger. They're not great. And anytime they know food's around, they'd stop tugging. They won't give it a shot.
Right. This is not exclusive to agility dogs, right? So we see this a lot, actually in teaching puppies to tug as well. So even with dogs that are eventually going to tug really well, lots of times, if I start with a working line puppy, when they're younger, their food drive is higher than their desire to chase or play or bite. And if there's any food around or they think there's a possibility of accessing food, then they're literally avoidant to the opportunity to tug. And so what I look for is there's two things we can do to work on that. One is kind of watch your dog's biorhythms. So your dog is going to have playful times and times that they're not so playful, right? And so mm-hmm. first thing in the morning, you know, 10 o'clock at night, whenever it is, where your dog is kind of offering to play, showing you their desire, and exploit those. Use those to rehearse the skills that are necessary in tugging. The other is don't build an expectation of food in a situation where you want to play tug. So I have this rule that I call the violation of expectation of rewards, right? And every dog has a hierarchy of value for their rewards. One dog likes food, and then he likes a tennis ball a little better, and he likes tugging the most, or he likes tugging, and then the tennis ball's next, or food is the most, or whatever it is. But there's some kind of hierarchy there. And if I've built up an expectation in a situation that a dog is going to get a certain type of reward, I can violate his expectations up the ladder of hierarchy, but I can't violate it down. So if I tell you I'm going to give you $25 to do a job, and I give you $50, you're happy. If I give you $5, you're angry, right? And you're not very motivated to work for me. And so one of the things that people have done with those dogs that like food more than tugging, then if around the agility equipment or on the agility field or in training situations they've used food a lot, they've built up that expectation of food. And so now the dog steps out there, says, aha, this we're doing agility, so I'm going to get food. And then you try to get them to play, and they're not going to. So you have to remove that expectation for a while. Put them in that circumstance, no food, just play, even if the play is weak, and give them the opportunity to do that until that expectation goes away. And then the final thing is you have to determine at the end of the day if your dog is going to ever like tugging more than they like food. Because once again, we look at tugging, it's a reward for behavior. And at the end of the day, if my dog likes food better, then I'm probably going to use food. I can't force him to like it better. But there are things that I can do while he rehearses it and practices it to make him like it more, and potentially I can get over that hump. There are lots of trainers that like to switch back and forth between food and toys, mm-hmm. and it's really convenient if you have a dog that will do that. But for another dog, it really inhibits the intensity of their play. If you have a very food dog and you give them food and then you try to get them to play, they feel gypped in a sense.
Interesting, because that has been, you know, kind of the common wisdom is that at least the goal is to have a dog that can switch back and forth that has equal value. But I think a lot of times the reality is that's a really tough goal to obtain.
Yeah, it takes a specific kind of dog and a handler that's rehearsed them both the whole way along. And I would say the majority of dogs are going to have a preference one way or the other, right? And there are dogs that will take food in a certain circumstance but would much rather have their toy. And there are dogs that will play with you but they're going through the motions. But they would much rather have food in that circumstance. And I do my best to set up the set of criteria so my dog can do both. But if they can't, then at some point you have to stop trying to force them to, because I think you undermine the value of both rewards that way.
I like what you said, too, about the biorhythms, because I just got a new puppy. He's 12 weeks old now, and he was waking me up early, early in the morning, and I would take him out, and he'd go to the bathroom, and then he'd immediately dive bomb my shoes and just go crazy.
Yep.
and I was half awake. But after one day of that, I said, all right, I guess this is the time. And I took out my toy, you know, at 6 a.m., which for me is really early.
I understand.
And just, you know, started playing with him. And boy, he was a maniac at 6 in the morning, just an absolute fool with the tug. So there's something to be said for, you know, just rolling with the punches a little bit.
And especially with play behaviors, because play behaviors is one of the things that probably bears mentioning at this point too, which is that play behaviors like tugging and chasing access a certain part of the dog's kind of brain chemistry based on prey behaviors, like the chasing and putting their mouth on things. And they tend to intensify through rehearsal. So the way your dog chases or tugs when it's young and how intensely it will do that later are wildly different. The more they rehearse it, the more into it they get. And so you frequently need to pay attention to those kind of biorhythms, for want of a better term, to jumpstart the process. And then the more you get to practice it, the more into it they get, and the more likely it's going to transfer to other situations. And so you can use that timing to jumpstart the whole process.
Yeah, and I think, I guess, to kind of rephrase what you just said, or my interpretation of it, is that there is a huge amount of value of doing what the dog wants to do, you know, what they're primed to do at that moment. And if it's something that you ultimately want them to do and you get in there and practice it when they're offering it, that's even better than trying to elicit it later.
Absolutely. And in a lot of cases, when you try to get the dogs to do it when they're not quite in the mood, then you can actually make them avoidant to your overtures to play. You see this a lot where people try too hard. They keep trying to force the dog to play tug with them to the point where the dog's like, all right, already, get that thing out of my face. And you can watch the dog sort of become avoidant to the handler every time the handler tries to encourage them to play. And so you don't want to force this. You want to see the seeds or the little impulses that wants to happen and kind of fan the flames and nurture it along. And trying to force the dog to do it when they're not in the mood is only going to make the dog avoidant to it.
Right. It sounds a lot like our 3-year-old. There's a certain mood with our 3-year-old where if you offer her candy, she will say no. She's going to say no to everything, you know? And, sometimes I think, you know, puppies and they're very similar in maturity, 3-year-olds and puppies. So I've got a lot of crossover learning going on here.
I know it's good. I all the way through my entire dog training career, it's never failed that new parents are sitting staring at you, nodding their head constantly when you're
right.
talking about dog training. Like they're like, oh yes, exactly. I think there's so many parallels between, I mean, humans are humans and dogs are dogs, but between early childhood experiences and training dogs, the level of consistency, the moods, the emotional swings, the whole thing.
Yeah.
Like they're all at play.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, as far as using tug in training, you know, I think agility people would be really happy if their dogs would tug with them in a distracting environment, especially one that you might see at a trial with a lot of other dogs around, you know, on dirt, little kids running around with hot dogs and food and things like that. And they'd love for their dog to bring their toy back to them. So another problem that we run into a lot, and we have this problem with one of our own dogs, is that your dog may love to tug, or they at least like it okay, but they like to run around with the toy, you know, and they like to drive by you, run by really close, and then take off again. And people aren't sure what the issue is because the dog seems to genuinely enjoy the tugging. They just don't want to bring that toy back.
Right. This is so common, it's painful, right? So this is maybe the biggest problem in tug play with dogs, I would say. And so here's one of the gig. I think some dogs are more what we call naturally possessive of the item, and their motivation for tugging is less about the activity of tugging and more about getting and possessing the item. And some dogs are like this genetically. You see it a lot in working line German Shepherds. They love to carry stuff around. You know, they've got to have their pacifier in their mouth, and they're very possessive of their items. They want to keep them and just carry them around. They're satisfied having them. And they'll tug, but they'll tug because they want to win it from you, not so much because the activity of tugging feels inherently good on some level, right? And they learn to do it to get their item. And so there's that kind of thing. And then part of it is also how people tug. And so sometimes if people tug very intensely with their dogs for long periods of time, when they finally let go of the item, the dog says, "Whew, I had to work really hard for this. There's no way I'm bringing it back." Right? Another thing that kind of informs that is they're afraid you're going to take it from them. And so lots of people, when they start tugging, they also start teaching the dog to let go, out, we call it, or give, or whatever. They teach the dog to release the toy, and they frequently have the dog release the toy when they want to take the toy back and go back to work again. And so the dogs start to say, "Hey, if I bring that thing to you, you're going to take it away from me." And so there are several ways we approach this. One is, don't tug too long and too intensely. Right? So tug kind of short, let them have it. Encourage them to bring it back, tug short, let them have it, encourage them to bring it back repeatedly. And if necessary, assuming your dog's old enough, have them on a line so they can't run around. And I don't so much use the line to make them come to me as to block them from enjoying that running around with it, right? I want to say the only place the game is going to be is here with me, and I can block them from running around and doing all that other stuff. And then I try to encourage them back to me, and when they come back, I use my marker, but it doesn't really matter. I say yes, and I grab the toy, and I tug lightly, and then I let them have it again immediately, and I move away from them, and they come towards me, and I grab the toy and tug a little bit and let them have it, and I try to get them to figure out that if they bring the item back to me, I'll play with them. I won't take it from you. And I may have whole sessions where I don't actually out the toy to ask the dog to give it up. I just play, let them have it, get them bring it to me, play, let them have it, get them to bring it to me. And at the end of the session, I let them carry it off, and I trade them for food or something at the end of the session. So they got to say, hey, it's kind of fun to do that. The other thing is if your dog is a very possession-driven dog, then sometimes you have to let them have it and do like one lap before you get them to come back to do it again, because their goal is possession. And so a little bit of letting them have it is essential, and then you build tugging. As they get better and better, you say, hey, you got to come back, and then we'll play again, and then you'll get to have it again. And then be careful about working too much on letting go and bringing back in the same sessions. Because letting go, taking it from them, as it were, even if you're going to give it right back to them, and bringing things back can be at odds with each other, and there can be conflicts there too.
That's interesting, because a lot of that is directly counter to, you know, what a lot of different instructors will tell you. You know, a lot of sessions for tugging tend to be very long. They kind of go on forever. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, you are taking the toy away. And this happens virtually 100% of the time. So even for us, it was a real shift to go to these very short sessions to immediately give up the toy and call the dog to us and then and re-engage them, but not necessarily with an all-out, super vigorous, long, several-minute mm-hmm. tug session. You know, that was different from what we had been doing before. So, you know, that's one interesting thing. And the other thing that we hear a lot from trainers, even agility instructors here, is that the dog can never at any time possess the toy, that, you know, you are always in control of the toy. you know, they have to out it with you. They never have access to it without you, that sort of thing. So it's interesting to hear you talk about with those dogs that are really possessive that sometimes they need to have that.
Yeah, it's what they find satisfying in the activity ultimately, right? So our goal here is to make them like playing with me. And if they never get from the session what they really want from the session, then they don't really care about playing with me. And so I have to balance that. Everybody, in an ideal world, it would be lovely if on day one of playing tug with my dog, I could make all these rules and I could say, okay, you only get to play tug when I say, you can only grab it when I say, you have to let go, you have to bring it back, and I keep it. And if you want to play, you have to come to me to play, right? That's the ideal. That's mm-hmm. great. Of course, that's a very rare dog that's going to play tug with all of that in the beginning. You have to let them feel empowered. You have to let them control the situation some. It can get out of hand, obviously, letting them control the situation too much, but I have to let them control the situation some. When I first started playing tug with dogs years and years ago, I started in AKC obedience when I was really young, and of course the general wisdom of that time was you don't play tug with your dogs. If you play tug with your dogs, you're just inviting them to, you know, kill you in your sleep. You're telling them it's okay to bite, right? And so, like, don't do this. It's dangerous, right?
It's old
and
school.
Then as paradigms shifted and people started to say, oh, you know, well, obviously the dogs aren't going to kill you, but you need to control the situation. You make all the rules. You always win. You know, the dog has to let go. They can't grab it unless you say, and all those things. And again, it's a really rare young dog that you can come out and make that many rules right off the bat. And so we have to look for ways to kind of empower the dog. And what I found is that a lot of the techniques that are used in protection sports really carry over to tugging with agility dogs or obedience dogs or any of them. So what I've looked for are techniques and parallels between dog disciplines a lot recently. And a lot of the techniques from protection work there. Like, we'll do a lot of, and we can get into this more later, but if we do a lot of, we teach the dog restraint on a harness. We use harnesses for drive building related stuff. So I use it in my obedience and things like that. I do restrained recalls and all that sort of thing, which I assume you guys do in agility as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. The agility trainers. So, but we do all of ours on a harness. And then we do play on a harness. Like, so somebody holds the dog on a harness and I tease the dog with a toy and then we let the dog grab the toy. And that frustration of being restrained builds motivation for the activity. And so that restraint can do it. And so I can build up drive and I kind of empower the dog. And when the dog bites the tug and tugs really hard, I let them rip it out of my hands and I let them win, as it were. And these are all techniques that we use in protection work, but it doesn't have to be protection work. It doesn't have to be me putting equipment on my body and having the dog bite me. It's just glorified play with restraint, frustration, and allowing the dog to control the situation a little bit with their power. They can win the item out from you. And that radically intensifies the dog's motivation for tugging.
But also, you know, from the example that you give, it's also a way to reinforce a very specific part of the play. So in your example, you know, the dog was really working for it and they, you know, they're working really hard to get that toy. And so when they finally manage it, you're kind of rewarding that by letting them get it. And in the same way, a lot of people will use tug and agility to teach a dog to weight shift back. And mm-hmm. you know, when you're doing that, a lot of times, you know, especially if the dog is a little bit of a weaker tugger, at that moment when they actually pull back and weight shift back, we'll let go. And in a sense, we're rewarding that weight shift, you know, like, yes, that's what I wanted. And you won, you know, because of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it could be win through possession or it could be win through you as an actor, right? So another parallel between protection sports and other dog training disciplines is the handler playing tug with their dog is like a decoy in protection work, or the person that gets bit. And your job is to respond to good behavior on the dog's part, to react. And so I can do it by letting the dog have the item, or I could also do it by, if the dog pulls, I can just let them pull me forward. I can go, oh gosh, aren't you strong? And I can give them verbal feedback and let them move me around with their behavior. So my responses to their efforts reinforce the behavior and make it more likely to happen in the future.
Well, and that's yet another parallel to parenting, because I know, you know, with the puppy, there's a lot of acting of, you know, oh gosh, you're doing so good. Oh, you're pulling me so hard. And with our Rottweiler, there was very little acting. That dog was pulling me pretty hard, right? So there's like a whole range of how you throw the game, you know, how you throw a chess match with a 5-year-old versus how you throw a chess match with, you know, a college student or something.
Yeah, and exactly. And you have to make your papillon feel like it can yank you off your feet.
Right, right.
Oh, I love it. I love the idea of talking about empowering the dogs. You know, I'm not sure that that's anything that people commonly think about when they're tugging with their dog, that, hey, not only am I motivating and building drive in my dog, but I'm really empowering them and giving them a lot of confidence.
And I thought that was an interesting thing about Shih Tzu training when we first looked into it, was that Shih Tzu trainers, they don't just want a dog that tugs. That dog has to have confidence. They cannot squash the confidence of the dog in any way and have a dog be a good protection sport dog. So that's something that you Shih Tzu trainers are very concerned with, the confidence of the dog.
Yeah, and I think in agility trainers should be too, right? So here's part of the thing, and one of the things that's most interesting to me about dog training across the board, but competitive dog training and protection sports tends to be a really good laboratory for this, but in protection sports, one of the things that's important is that the dog obviously has to have high levels of motivation and confidence, and the dog has to be able to work independently of me, out away from me, and confront adversity in their life, as it were. But they also have to listen to me and be under control. I have to have control of all that stuff. Unfettered drive and no control isn't any good either. And agility trainers want the same thing. You need a dog that's confident. If you're going to be competitive in agility, you have to go travel into the circumstances you said, some new building that your dog's never been in, and it's noisy and there are people everywhere. And if I have an environmentally sensitive or a dog that lacks confidence, that's a problem. They can't play. And the dog has to be dependent on me for direction, but he also be able to work independently of me at a distance. They have to be confident in making choices and committed choices away from me. And so we all want kind of the same things. We want a kind of more intense, assertive version of it in protection sports, but really we like the same kind of mentality in our dogs. And a lot of the techniques are the same, I think, between the two.
Absolutely. I don't think that it's any coincidence that among the top trainers in agility, you see a lot of the things that you have over there on the Shih Tzu side, you know, as far as restraint recalls and tugging and things like that, ideas that we get from the top trainers here. You know, I do just see a lot of crossover between the sports at the very highest levels. And I think as it kind of trickles down to the mainstream, the general audience, you know, it's a message that gets out there. But I think a lot of people are surprised to know, you know, by the time it reaches them, that a lot of this is going on in other dog sports or even may have originated there. And this is one of the reasons that we were so excited to have you on and really expose our audience to, you know, someone from another sport and yet have so much application to agility at the very highest levels as well.
I love cross-pollination. It's great. It's cool.
We're bees.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
Ideas come from all kinds of places. And when I was doing protection sports, some of the best techniques I learned were from high-level AKC obedience trainers. And I've watched agility people do all kinds of directed handling and stuff like that. And there's great ideas everywhere. And we just have to keep our minds open to them.
And that's it for this week's podcast. In the next podcast, we'll continue our conversation with Michael Ellis and discuss some more common training issues, as well as how to adjust your tug training for your puppy. We'd like to thank Advo Agility for sponsoring today's show. Take the Advo Agility 24-Day Challenge, a comprehensive supplementation and nutrition program for the human half of your agility team. The 24-Day Challenge is designed to give your body the jumpstart it needs to meet your weight loss goals, as well as the edge to meet your athletic performance goals. Visit AdvoAgility at AdvoAgility.com and visit us at BadDogAgility.com for agility articles, videos, and podcasts. Happy training!